words of Michael Jordan, I'm back. This is Rick Hogan coming back to the airwaves after a two-month interlude. One of those months spent being quite sick with COVID-19, and the last month feeling just great. I hope everyone out there is well and safe. And my first guest, and I decided to do this because whenever I get confused about the world, I seek insight from my friend, Father John Cusick. John, how are you?
Well, Rick, I'm fine, and I am so thrilled that you're back on the air. You have no idea.
You didn't know what to do on Sunday nights from 9 to 11?
Well, no, I didn't. And I just checked your Facebook page.
Yeah.
And since you posted your agenda for tonight, you have 518 people who click like, 211 comments, and 21 people shared your post. So that's 750 responses.
Well,
and I get to say welcome on behalf of all of them and many more.
That's because I always get that kind of response whenever you're on, usually around over the holidays.
No.
Where are you now, Father Cusick? Are you up in Wisconsin?
I'm sitting on my front porch in Fontana, Wisconsin.
Have you been up there for the, I say the entire 2 months, but that's just my personal feeling.
3 months.
How long have you been up?
Well, you missed a month because of COVID, that 3 months.
Yeah.
I was sitting out in Arizona. I landed in Phoenix the day they canceled spring training.
Mm.
And 2 days later, I said, I got to get out of here. And I was able to get a flight on United, and I came back, and the next day the world shut down. So.
Yeah.
I've been up here, and it's a good place to be.
How are you dealing with it, John? As a man who has spent a great deal of his time surrounded by other people, meaning in church, surrounded by other people, meaning also at funerals, how jarred are you by the world in which we're living right now?
Well, I mean, it's like playing a card game, and someone threw all the cards up in the air, and you have to figure out, you know, your hand.
Yeah.
I live, I think, like many of us do, Rick, with the unknown of we do not know what is going to be. Whatever was before the middle of March ain't coming back.
True.
And I just don't know. I mean, you don't even have people giving, you know, knowledge to predictions right now. It's a crapshoot.
Well, it's wild. It's wild guesses and a lot of pontificating. Do you think, I mean, essentially, this might ease in the possibility that there is a vaccine developed for this late this year, next year, years from now. But what occurs to me is something similar. There's no AIDS vaccine. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
I mean, with all the people working and all the money involved and all the scientists involved, certain people have had to change their lifestyles to avoid that deadly scourge. Are you, you are a hopeful man, though. You are hopeful.
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming that a vaccine will be discovered, and that people will be able to sit next to one another in church. How does, John, for you, is no longer an active, you're a retired priest, whatever that may mean, to conduct sermons in a church that is filled with people separated by 6 feet? How does that change the nature of the mass, of the proceedings, of the funerals, of the baptisms? It must change it in very profound way for the time being, yes?
Well, yeah, in two different ways. You know, Rick, that a couple of priest friends of mine lost a parent in the last 3 months, and after living long, healthy lives, Jack Wall's mother was 101 years old.
Oh, my.
And Father Tom Hurley's father, Dr. Jack Hurley, was a legend coming out of Little Company Mary Hospital.
Sure.
on the south side of Chicago. And there were 10 people at each of their funerals.
Mm.
I mean, it just breaks your heart.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, these are people who they're larger than life, and the lives they've touched and the years they've lived. So it's very, very difficult that way. For me, I've presided twice at Mass over live stream, and to be at the altar at Old St. Pat's and have literally nobody in the church.
Yeah.
And you're looking at a lens very much like we would be on television.
Sure.
Because that's technically what we were. But I wound up, I looked at the data after last week's Mass, and there were 15,000 computers that clicked on to that Mass.
Wow. Wow.
15,000 computers. Now, let's say that there's two people behind each computer.
Sure.
Rick, there's 30,000 people in a church that seats 800. So that there's bad news because we cannot be together physically. But in terms of getting the message out, whoever thought that you'd have between 15 and 30,000 opportunities?
Well, it's a changed delivery system that reaches a wider audience.
Exactly.
How do you think though that might change the nature of your delivery of what you're saying?
Well, I think it has. I mean, I think live stream and a lot of internet things and with this Zoom stuff and other kind of things. There's so many different ways of connecting that we never thought possible.
Yeah.
And I think if you see what is the upside of it, and not the downside is there's no people in front of you.
Exactly.
The upside is you got 15,000 computers on.
Right.
So it's
quality.
There's something going on.
Quality and quantity. I hear the same thing about higher education these days, that universities are going to shrink because, oh my goodness, we found out that we can do this kind of remote learning. And I think remote learning will become more sophisticated in the delivery system. Sometimes when you do, and I've done a couple, I interviewed Phil Donahue and Marlo Thomas via Zoom, and it was just... It was a little awkward. In fact, I eventually got in the rhythm of it, but it was a little awkward. And I'm just assuming the technology is going to get much hipper and much more sophisticated. And a lot of people who used to do things together will now be doing things remotely. I haven't figured out the world, John. That's why I needed to talk to you. I think it troubles me.
But I think that the thing, Rick, that I hunger for is the human connection.
Yep.
You can talk about the technology of going from 800 people in front of you to 15,000 computers.
Right.
But
right.
What you want, I want to be able to go down and shake a hand, throw my arm around somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I want when people come up to communion, I can watch people who are in tears. I can watch people who have joy on their face.
Yeah.
I see the human community walk in front of me.
Yeah.
And I can't do that now.
Who knows if it'll come back, but there is indeed, John Cusack, I think something lost. And I think people are feeling that now. Just the fact that many people in the building where I live are older and are terrified to leave their apartment, even to go for a walk. And not that there are many people out walking around unless they're in a protest march. I feel for them because many of them are older and they used to get something out of that the human parade, right. The human carnival that's out there. I am speaking. Right. My first guest on my return to the airwaves is Father John Cusack, safe up in Wisconsin. And we got to take a little commercial break because people still pay money for commercials on the radio. And we'll be back. And I want to talk about what's been going on over the last 2 weeks. I think that's...
Breaks my heart.
Oh, mine too, pal. Mine too. We will be back in a couple minutes. It's Rick Hogan back in his WGN chair and happy to be here too. Talking with one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite people on this planet, Father John Cusack, formerly of Old St. Pat's and sort of still of Old St. Pat's. We were talking about the coronavirus, which is likely to become an even bigger story than it was before the tragic death of Mr. Floyd a couple weeks ago, because, John, I got, and I'm not scared. I'm immune, having had COVID. I'm immune, and I'm not contagious. So I'm kind of like a super human being out there. But when I saw, and I was out a bit over the weekend, some observing and participating in some marches and seeing no social distancing and a very, very small percentage of these crowds wearing masks, I am fearful of another nationwide spike. You too?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, what's happened since Minneapolis is that we put COVID not on the back burner, but, you know, sort of, you know, in the closet.
Absolutely.
And it is a deadly disease.
Yeah.
And you dodged a bullet, and you know that.
Yes,
and,
I do.
110,000 citizens in our country were not able to dodge the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm afraid. I really am. And living up here in southern Wisconsin, I mean, it's like Dodge City before the law.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court says, well, the governor's thing is unconstitutional, but they didn't tell people what to do.
Exactly.
And so I went for my walk today down along the beach in Fontana, and there's a watering hole down there, which is very, very famous. And I'm telling you, Rick, there had to be 300 people inside that bar.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it's like sitting on a hand grenade.
Yeah.
I don't understand people. Do they think they're immortal? I don't get it.
Well, I mean, anybody, you know, you're 25 and you don't have any underlying health issue. I mean, I thought I was immortal and I was, you know, not 25 and in perfect health. But I think we really seem to have lost. I talked to a bunch of people today who were out and about in the city, and they're like, wow. And you're still talking about every single business, with one or two exceptions, on Michigan Avenue is seriously boarded up. Still.
Correct.
And I'm talking to people going, won't it be great? All these places are going to open tomorrow, and we're going to have outdoor dining, and everything's going to be great, and people are going back to work.
No.
And I'm just saying, I understand the enthusiasm, but it's enthusiasm rather than well-grounded optimism, to my mind.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also without any strategy that the world is larger than me. It's about us. You know, I mean, that thing about, well, I've got my rights. I don't need to wear a mask. You may not need to wear a mask for you, but darn it, you need to wear a mask for me.
Exactly. And, that's you know, the whole point. I did an experiment before the Flynn fallout, as the Tribune is calling it. I started to ask people on Michigan Avenue why people who were not wearing masks, I would go up to them and say, excuse me, you got a second? And I said, can I ask you why you aren't wearing a mask? And the answers were among some of the most ridiculous. It was one of the hardest interviews I've ever done, because half the people didn't want to speak to me. The others said, F you, and just walked on. And I'm thinking, this is not a political statement. Why aren't you wearing a mask? That is something I just do not understand.
Well, I mean, not everybody has been there and done that, as you have, you know, the first month you were out.
Yeah.
You understand that you could have died.
Correct.
It's that simple. It's not black. It's black and white.
Yep.
I beat a deadly virus.
Right.
It's pretty simple.
Yep.
I mean, let me give an example up here, which was bizarre. After they left the lid off, I needed to get a haircut. Honest to God, I mean, I look like I was back in the 60s. So I drove by my barber shop up here, and the barber was not wearing a mask. Now, he's 4 inches from people's head.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I called to get an appointment, and I asked him a question, will you be wearing a mask? And he said, no. I said, would you wear a mask to cut my hair? And he said, well, if you would want me to, I will do it. I said, well, I would like you to wear a mask.
Good for you.
He said, fine, I will do it.
Good for you.
And to his credit, when I stayed out in the street until the guy ahead of who was in the chair had left, and I was waved in, because I'm not going to be
sure.
I don't want to be around a lot. Yeah,
why take a chance?
And so I go in, and to his credit, he put on a mask for
good.
Me. But why wouldn't he do that all day?
Well, I'm almost surprised. I'm almost surprised he didn't say, you know, it's going to cost you $2 extra if I wear a mask or something like that.
Well,
John, I know that the pain the pain that is radiated from that horrific, horrific murder in Minneapolis in a variety of ways and radiated everywhere. It's radiated around the world. It's got to be heartbreaking for you. It is for me to watch people fighting for most people fighting for what is their right.
Right. And it's and then of course the conflict inside of me between we want what's best for people and Black lives do matter and darn it we've got to change the system, and yet the looters and the rioters and the arsonists they have taken the cause and driven it into the ground, and that's what bothers me so much, that it's one step forward and 20 steps back.
I agree. And you and I are similar age, and I remember distinctly, and I understand why, but distinctly the riots in the wake of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination on the West Side going up in flames. Right. And you know as well as I do that many of those blocks that were burned down in 68 have never come back. And that's my fear here for whatever kind of all the yammering and, the yammering of politicians tends to quiet and stop after a while. The yammering of politicians, in many ways, I'm fearful for some of these neighborhoods and small business owners who are never going to get back. Aren't you?
There was a live helicopter shot of a strip mall at 56 and Wentworth.
Yeah.
And people weren't running in and looting. They were walking in like they were going to a flea market. I'm watching as a woman carried out a mattress. I mean, not running, not just carrying out a mattress. And some people helped her put it on the top of her car, and the car very casually drove away.
Yeah.
Now, that strip mall, every single store in the strip mall is gone.
Yeah.
56th and Wentworth.
Yeah.
What is it going to take? That's a poor community.
I know. The stores on, the stores on Oak Street and Michigan Avenue will come back. I have no idea what some of the random looters will be doing with a, $3,000 Prada bag that they woke up to, Monday morning or whatever morning they had gotten it. It just, all of these problems need solutions. And I think one of the things that I feel now is everybody is expecting a very quick solution to problems that are 400 years old.
Exactly. Yeah. I had a very tough week. I was really deep into the darkness of my soul trying to figure out how I, a 74-year-old white guy, can continue to learn more about the injustices that people have told me about since this happened in Minneapolis, that they've lived with and what they've gone through, and the subtle racism that I, as a white guy, could never possibly understand, and they go through all the time.
Yeah,
I was dying 1,000 deaths inside of myself because in all my life, I fought against these things, and we're back to square one. What's changed? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either, and that's what it gives me great pause. When do you think you might venture down to Chicago?
Well, I actually came down to your old neighborhood last week, down to Old Town, and as I crossed North Avenue going from the expressway east, seeing everything boarded up, it just tore up my soul.
Yeah.
I don't know what to even say anymore. All I do is something has got to change. There's got to be but Rick, I remember, I'm old enough to remember that in the Catholic community before 1968, there was a movement for married couples, white couples, to meet with Black couples.
Uh-huh.
And they were doing this from Catholic church to Catholic church. One of them was from Park Ridge down to the 81st and Prairie, St. Clotilde. And because of dialogue, people talking to each other, you began to understand each other.
Exactly.
And you could begin to see social change.
Exactly.
However,
Yes.
The night that Dr. King was killed, an iron curtain came down, and all the dialogue ended.
Yep.
I think today, and we can talk about, you know, defunding police and all that stuff. I don't know where all that's going. But we've got to learn to talk to one another.
That's the whole thing.
That's what's key.
That's the whole thing. That's what I hope people were doing in these marches, that they were meeting people who are not like themselves and can come to understand what it's like to live in Lawndale and not Lincoln Park. John, I miss you terribly. Thanks for being the premier of the show.
Oh, my God.
You were a bolt of enlightenment for me. Take care of your sweet self. Will you be well?
And you are so important to Chicago, just so you know that.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, I would, but and to me personally.
Thank you, John.
I'm glad you're back.
Me too, pal. Me too. Thank you.
Take care. Great health, my friend.
Okay, be well. Bye. Be well. That was Father John Cusick, and these are some commercials. Welcome back. Before I tell you about John Kennedy Toole and his remarkable book, Confederacy of Dunces, and a new, very clever, very insightful, very moving novel based on that book and John Kennedy Toole, I want to tell you just a little about Jody Blanco, one of the co-authors. She was, when I first met her, an extraordinary publicist. Among her clients at the time were the famous football player Jim Brown. I think, Jody, hi, how are you?
Hi, Rick. I think
Mickey Rooney. Was Mickey Rooney one of your clients?
Yes, he was.
And a fascinating, the way we met was through one of her clients named Mr. Blobby, about whom... about whom I remember nothing except his name. She then went on to have an equally extraordinary career as an author and speaker about bullying, a New York Times bestseller called Please Stop Laughing at Me. These books were very, very personal, and I think that's why Jody's become this kind of extraordinarily popular and inspiring speaker about that topic. This book, young Jody Blanco, written with your old friend Kent Carroll, really just blew me away. I looked at I saw it, came to my desk. It says, I, John Kennedy Toole. I thought, okay, it's a biography of one of my favorite authors. And then I looked down, and it says, a novel based on a true story. And then I looked down, and I see Kent Carroll, and I only know him because he's a friend of yours. And Jody Blanco, you too, and Kent's been we'll get to what he is. He's a legendary publisher. And you two started out with the intention of writing a relatively straightforward biography of this guy who sadly and tragically committed suicide at 31 without ever knowing that his book, Confederacy of Dunces, would eventually posthumously win the Pulitzer Prize. It didn't go well. There wasn't a lot out there for two people seeking to write a conventional biography, was there?
No, you know, it's really interesting. At first, Kent and I thought, yes, we wanted to do a biography of the novel itself, backstory of the novel itself. And Kent had a really sort of provocative and unique connection to the book because he was the publisher back in 1981 who really sort of discovered the book in the mainstream New York publishing community and championed it to grow where it grew to become. I mean, it became a New York Times bestseller and a Pulitzer Prize winner because Kent rolled up his sleeves and championed that book when he was a young editor at Grove Press.
Well, and he took it from, it was originally published by the University of Louisiana Press, I think, and did fairly well there. And then, to Kent's credit, he exploded it into the mainstream. And what I realized, Jody, just from, you know, I don't always trust Facebook or Twitter or stuff, but when I mentioned on those sites that you were going to be on, it reminded me how beloved this book, A Confederacy of Dunces, was, and remains. It is something of a literary phenomenon, don't you think?
Well, it's a literary phenomenon for a variety of reasons. Number one, you know, there's the story of what Kenny Toole went through. I mean, imagine, here's a kid who was raised by a mother who was clearly mentally ill,
yep.
a father who slipped into dementia far younger than he should have. Kenny was an only child, and he started writing this book when he was in his 20s in Puerto Rico when he was drafted for the Army.
Right.
And his whole life is in this book, and I would argue that the character of Ignatius Riley is most certainly Kenny's alter ego.
Well, I don't want to ruin the book, and it would be impossible to ruin the book unless I just read it for the next 3 hours over the air. There are portions of the book where Ignatius Riley sort of coexists with John Kennedy Toole. These parts must have been very difficult to write because they're very inventive, but they are sort of joined at the psychic hip for much of the book, aren't they?
Yeah, and that wasn't an accident. When we started doing this book, Kent and I decided we wanted to do extensive research, and so there aren't many friends left alive of
right.
Kenny's because, you know, I mean, Kenny would have been well into his 80s now, so he has one best friend who's still living, who's out in Maryland, and I spent a weekend with him, a wonderful, wonderful gentleman named Joel Fletcher. And I said to Joel, I said, it's not so much specific memories, because you've written about Kenny, and I just want your impressions of him as his best buddy, what you miss about him. Mm. Just reminisce and talk to me. And those insights are really what led to Ignatius being such a prominent character in our novel, because he really believed that Ignatius, that character for John Kennedy Toole, it was partially an alter ego, because if you think about it, since that book was published, A Confederacy of Dunces, in 1980 and then won the Pulitzer in 81,
mm-hmm.
since all of that happened, what's really strange about this book, Rick, and you know the publishing industry,
yeah.
is that men gravitate towards this book.
Sure.
Most books, it's women that are the book buyers in America.
Mm-hmm.
But A Confederacy of Dunces, men gravitate towards the book. And I think the reason why is because Ignatius is free. And I think it's that sense of freedom that he is whoever he wants to be. He's this crazy John Belushi-like character. And I think men identify with that, and they gravitated towards his sense of freedom. So when we decided to write the novel, honestly, Rick, I read every single thing available in the archives that John Kennedy Toole ever wrote.
Yeah.
Whether it was a recipe on the back of a paper plate or it was his deepest journals or letters. And based on all of that, I researched this book for 3 years.
I know.
And based on all of that, Ignatius just emerged organically.
Yeah.
And I sort of pretended, when Ken and I wrote this, I sort of pretended, okay, Kenny, I'm going to close my eyes. Tell me what you want to say. And then I just typed.
See, here's something you write in this. Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco write this. When Corporal Toole was began to write the book, you write, it was getting to the point he couldn't tell the two apart. Sometimes he found himself in a situation in which he'd normally be cool and calm, an ordinary circumstance by any civilized person's definition, and then Ignatius would pop out like a rotund, black-haired jack-in-the-box, spewing opinions. When he'd become excited, his large round eyes would bulge, animating his face. Ignatius was more than a fictional character to his creator. He was the person John Kennedy Toole wanted to be. That's one of the seminal paragraphs of this book, Jody, and it hit me very, very hard. Toole was his dad is a kind of sad character here, John Dewey Toole wrote what he wore, what was left of his potential with dignity, his once powerful frame now shrunken as if an apology belied the integrity of his character. But his mom, Thelma, is a case and a half. I mean, she is especially, she was more than a she was a stage mother for a while because he had a brief sort of a fling with acting, but she was nuts. in a word.
Yeah, Thelma Tuhle, I think, probably most certainly was a borderliner at a narcissistic disorder. But the thing about Thelma Tuhle that's really interesting is that she suffocated Kenny in life, but she breathed his immortality.
Well, that is, if anybody knows, there's so many insights in this book, but if anybody knows anything about the saga of John Kennedy Toole and his book, A Confederacy of Dunces, it's that, you know, crazy Mrs. Toole went to Walker Percy, and mm-hmm. Walker Percy, just to get rid of her, said, sure, I'll read your kid's book. And that thus begins the journey. What you have in here, too, you're wonderful about him in college. You're wonderful about, is the Neon Bible is the other book. I'm not even thinking about maybe the mystery book. Is the Neon Bible any good, Jody?
That's interesting. I read the Neon Bible, and, you know, he wrote that when he was 16 years old.
Right.
So for a 16-year-old, it's extraordinary.
Okay.
But it devastated him because he wrote that book for a literary competition when he was 15 years old and lost.
Yeah.
Or 16 years old and lost. And so he just kind of let that book go. But what's really interesting is that you see vestiges of characters in that book that would be more mature characters in the Confederacy of Dunces.
Yeah.
And Kenny wrote, I mean, there's a lot of mythology about Kenny Toole and the Confederacy of Dunces, but some of that mythology, I think there could be kernels of truth. You know, there's a rumor out there that there's a lost manuscript that Kenny was
working
on a book
when he died. Yeah.
And I believe that's absolutely possible, and that's why we incorporated that into our book.
The story of Humphrey Wildblood, right?
Yeah, I mean, because that was a character that Kenny had invented when he was very young, and he did some, you know, sort of rudimentary comics around that character, and he had a connection to that character. He would write about that character in his journal entries, and, you know, in my mind, that Kenny wouldn't have been working on a book when he died seems to me more unbelievable than that he was.
Right, right. You do, ladies and gentlemen, you will be, Jody, what do you think? Do you think people should read A Confederacy of Dunces before they read I, John Kennedy Toole? Because if they don't, they will certainly read it after they read I, John Kennedy Toole.
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
When we wrote it, I really wanted something. We wanted something that would be a standalone. So if somebody is a fan of A Confederacy of Dunces, though, this book will resonate for them.
No question.
But if they've never read A Confederacy of Dunces at all, you can still read this book, and it may make you curious about Dunces.
Yeah.
But the thing about what we wanted to get across is that this is larger than the sum of its parts. Kenny's struggle for recognition, his struggle to be published, is the struggle of every writer, every artist, every dreamer.
Well, when we come back, I got to take a short commercial break. I am on with Jody Blanco, a talented writer on her own, but with her old friend Kent Carroll, a giant of the American publishing industry. They have come up with I, John Kennedy Toole. Cool title, too, Jody. I, John Kennedy Toole. It's a novel based on a true story, the true story of John Kennedy Toole and his seminal book, A Confederacy of Dunces. The question I want to talk about when we get back is the utter rejection, the sort of wild dance that Toole had to have with famous publisher Robert Gottlieb, and we will be back in 2 minutes. Welcome back. I'm talking with Jody Blanco, the co-author with Kent Carroll of I, John Kennedy Toole. A very clever novel based on a true story. They've taken and digested all they can about the author John Kennedy Toole, whose most famous book and his really one book, A Confederacy of Dunces, is a literary phenomenon of the 20th century. Jody, I got to ask you, is this reporter Bill Greeley real?
No, Bill Greeley, that was why we needed to do it. Be a fiction because there were certain parts of the story that were gaps. Like, for example, you know, his death certificate was destroyed in a fire. Other papers were destroyed in Hurricane Katrina. So we needed to have a device to move the narrative along
and to ask
the question that the reader would naturally ask.
Yeah.
So that's where he came from.
He's a reporter, and he is a good character, and he runs into you get to the whole sort of movie, you know, when it was published and ever since. A wide variety of pretty big talents has wanted to turn this into a film, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you address very well. For someone who doesn't know the history of Confederacy of Dunces, Ignatius Reilly is a tough character to cast, but you mentioned earlier John Belushi. I think he would have been quite magnificent if he was straight and sober.
Well, what's interesting about that is that Steven Soderbergh, who for decades has been trying to produce this film,
I know.
He's actually stated that he thinks there's a curse on the book, because every major actor who was ever slotted to play Ignatius Reilly, they agree to do it and then they die.
Yeah,
it's strangest thing.
Chris Farley, yeah, it's.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, a lot of them.
Well, the other thing, the dance he did with Robert Gottlieb, who was, I don't remember what, Simon & Schuster or whatever firm he was, mm-hmm. who initially, I don't know if he led Tool around or got his hopes up, but that dance is really, really painful for me to read in the book, because Tool did a lot of revisions because of Gottlieb and then eventually got tossed over by him.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, there are articles, and the media has covered this on and off over the years, that choreography between Gottlieb and Kenny. But the thing about Robert Gottlieb is that he's still alive. He's an esteemed editor. I mean, he published Catch 22. I mean, he's
legendary.
He's legendary.
Yes.
But the thing about Gottlieb is everyone has tried to vilify him, but I don't think he's the villain here. What Kent and I really thought, and it was difficult to sort of communicate this in the book, is that Gottlieb isn't the villain here. It's just that he got this extraordinary manuscript, but it was so different from anything else that was out there.
Right,
He didn't want to let it go, but he didn't know what to do with it. Sort of like a guy who dates an extraordinary woman, and he doesn't know what to do with her, but he doesn't want her to date anybody else either. It was kind of the same thing.
That's well put. The other thing that I didn't know, I knew a bit about the Tool's life as much as anybody who reads magazines and newspapers would know, but he had two relationships kind of with Ellen and Ginny, and what you do with his dinner with Ellen in New York in this book is really, you both of you, it's magnificent. It addresses, I think, his kind of a slight awkwardness and a wistfulness. It's really a remarkable section of the book. That's all I want to tell you. And you,
well, I love you for saying that, because you know we've known each other a long time, and that was tricky to write. And but you know, a secret we can tell you're just between us.
Yes, of course. Secret, no one's listening.
The character of Ellen is that actually, in all of Tool's archives, and I mean, Kent and I poured through thousands and thousands.
Oh, sure.
Right? There was a love letter from a young girl during the time that Kenny was a professor in New York. There was a love letter, and it was very cryptic about how much she missed him and how her mom asked all the time. Only one letter, but there was so much passion and pathos in that letter that letter was the inspiration for the character of Ellen. She is very much a flesh and blood woman, and I wonder if she is alive, and I wonder if she knows that likely she was Kenny's muse.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be interesting? Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You do a remarkable job, too, where he really starts to lose his bearings. I mean, it almost comes off as schizophrenia. It's very, very sad where he and Ignatius are sort of coexisting. That must have been difficult to write.
It was difficult to write. It was difficult to write because there's a delicate balance there, and Kent was really good at making sure that I straddle that balance
yeah.
of grace.
Yeah.
Because if you go too far in that direction, it becomes hokey and over the top.
Absolutely.
So to keep it dignified, that's where Kent's wisdom, experience, and sanguinity really came into play, because I'm kind of over the top and in your face.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, no, we got to be
no, Jody, no, like, no. Okay.
Right.
the other thing, the narrative arc of this book, I find terribly, terribly appealing. It starts, and the book occasionally will flit back and forth through time, but especially in that opening chapter where one life is ending, and it's kind of the balance of one life. A human life is ending, and a literary sort of creation is fighting to come into existence. Is that the way you see that first chapter, too?
Yes, and yeah. that's actually the you know, I believe that every book, and I was a book publicist for years, right?
Yes, you were.
And I believe that every book needs to have a message that the reader can internalize and take away, and it can affect internal change with the reader.
Sure.
And the message for us, at least, was that, you know, the consensus, the linear sort of unidimensional consensus about Kenny Toole is that he was devastated when Gottlieb didn't publish his book. He descended into madness and he killed himself.
Right.
But what Kent and I suggest is something a little bit different. We suggest that Kenny's completing suicide wasn't so much an act of despondence and hopelessness,
mm-hmm.
but more of an act of sacrifice, that he sacrificed himself so that his characters might live.
That's because exactly how I read it, and I think you've done a remarkable job with doing that. When he died, after his death, and his very sad funeral, his mom sits on the book for a couple of years, and then she goes nuts at trying to sell it. It keeps getting rejected all the time, Jody. And why? I've read the book and love the book. I've probably read it 3 or 4 times, and everybody I know who has read it loves the book. What is your theory on the serial rejections that magnificent book got, because it didn't fit into some genre or into some
right? It broke the rules.
Yeah.
It got rejected then for the same reason that so many brilliant books are getting rejected right now as you and I are having this conversation.
Yep.
Because so, you know, everyone thinks of the artistic world, and publishing certainly falls under that auspices, as being proactive and being risk-taking. But the reality is that most industries today are still reactive, not proactive. They'll follow a trend before they'll start a trend.
Sure, because you know this better than I do. When you're writing a proposal for any sort of book, what they want in the proposal is, this book will be reminiscent of Joseph Wambaugh's cop books and James Patterson's this, and you're so right about that. I think another wonderful seminal line in this whole thing is when Crazy Old Thelma is remarkably makes a good showing on the Tomorrow Show. She's with a publicist for Grove Press. And the Grove Press publicist asks, I've read the book twice. It's living inside my head. And then Thelma replies, and this is such a great 2 sentences about the book. It's a wonder and a mystery, she replied. And of course, it killed my son. That sums up so much of this book. How did you guys work together? You write different portions of it, or did you bang out the whole thing and then
No, the way we work and the way we work is sort of the way we always work, because he, you know, he was very instrumental, and please stop laughing at me too.
Oh yeah.
Is that Kent is my mentor. So
I know. Yeah.
He's been my mentor for 35 years. So what we would do is we figured out the structure of the book together, the basic fundamental scaffolding. And then I would write a chapter, and then I would give it to him, and then he would edit it and rework it and reshape it. And then we would finalize that chapter, and we did it one chapter at a time, where I would do the initial draft. He would do sort of he would edit and hone it and refine it, and then we move on to the next chapter. And then when we had the whole book together, then he looked at it sort of holistically. So he was sort of the he was the one who did the refining and the contouring, and he helped with the overall arc of the book. So it really was a collaborative effort.
Well, it's a great, great collaboration. Again, the book is I, John Kennedy Toole, very recently published, a novel based on a true story by Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco. You tell Kent Carroll, who I still don't think I've ever met him, you two make a great team, Jody. This is a really remarkable book, and you've done this sad but extraordinarily talented writer who committed suicide at 31, real justice. And you're going to sell a lot of copies of Confederacy of Dunces for him, too. Jody, it's great to talk to you, honey.
Great to talk to you, Rick.
Sending Take care
you the
of
biggest
yourself.
Hug ever. Okay.
Thanks, sweetie. Take care. Take care. Be safe. Be well. We got a commercial, get some news, and the man delivering the news will then be in here to talk about his book. That would be Roger Badish. Welcome back. This is Rick Kogan. Happy to be back after 2 months away. One of them in a real nasty fight with COVID-19, and the second month saying, thank God, man. Roger Badish is my colleague here. He is the newsman. He is the voice you hear delivering the news, not only on this show, but a number of other shows. I started having him into the studio some time ago just to talk about his life. At one point, I think it was because he said, well, Rick, did you know that I installed the stereo system for Harold Washington? And I went, what? How did that happen? Well, I used to work for Jane Byrne, and did I ever know Jay McMullen? I'm like, what kind of life have you had? He blames me in part for what I'm holding in my hands. It is a 302-page magnificent book filled with a bunch of fabulous photos, too. That is Roger's life. It's The Unplanned Life, The Journey of Roger Badish. It's published by Eckhart's Press, run by Rick Camphor and his buddy. And it is a magnificent book that Roger, before I saw it, said, well, Rick, it's just a bunch of this stuff I wrote on Facebook. And then I gave it to Rick Camphor, and then I had to cut 200,000 words out of it. And that's it. Roger, I must tell you, in all no-joking honesty, I understand the first line of your preface. I didn't want to write this book, but I am very, very glad you did. It's wildly self-effacing because you do not think you've had an extraordinary life. What have people who have read the book told you about yourself, Roger Badish?
Couple of things. Which I didn't realize, kind of unrelated to the details in it, is the writing style. I've had quite a number of messages online, people that I know here locally on the phone who have read it, that it's like I'm talking to them, which I don't think any of my English teachers in high school would have agreed with.
Well, what did they know?
Yeah, right.
Bunch of old
actually,
guys.
Yeah. Well, actually, there a couple of.
Yeah,
they brought a lot out of me, and I'm glad they did because I didn't take English seriously enough.
One of the things that also impressed me about this is this your self-effacing nature for this is you have decided to change careers any number of times. Mm-hmm. Prodded by some economic reasons, prodded by desire. Now do you think of yourself as an author?
I've written a book. I consider Shakespeare an author. I'm not Shakespeare. I consider you
hold on,
an author.
Hold on. I'm not Shakespeare. Every author since Shakespeare could have said that and they would, and they would have been right. But have you, you know, getting praise for the book and having accomplished the book, you still can't.
I'm not at that level. It's like a lot of the stuff that I've done in life has been totally unplanned. The title actually says it. I didn't plan to write the book. I thought I might write something. My father self-published, you know, going to Kinko's with your with his manual typewriter pages, making copies and binding it together in a plastic cover so his grandchildren and great-grandchildren could have some history of their grandfather and grandmother and the relatives, his brothers and sisters and her family. And I saw that, and I when he gave it to me, I put it in a bookcase.
Of course.
I'm like, well, I know who he is.
Yeah, I know who you are, Dad.
But in writing the book, yes, I had to cut 200,000 words out of it. Much of it was about my mother and father and what way they went through, how they met and got together and had a family and did all that they did. And in doing that part, I pulled out his book, and I learned things about him I had not known.
But you're very tender and very telling about your, just read one paragraph. Mom and Dad were very, all in caps, frugal with their funds. Both were working full-time jobs at this time. All their money went into the bank except specific amounts they kept in envelopes in their bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
Each envelope was for a specific item, groceries, cigarettes, they both smoked, spending money for one of my grandfathers. There were about 10 envelopes, all filled with cash. Withdrawals were detailed on the front of each envelope. I find that just such a telling, wonderful kind of observation. That,
yeah.
And I think the envelopes, you know, sort of punctuates the fact that they were frugal. I mean, very careful with
yeah.
money. You love your mom and dad, did you not?
Very much. But I think as in most families, we were a typical family.
Not really, but yeah.
Well, but
you look like the other families in your Evanston neighborhood.
Exactly.
Let's put it that way.
Exactly. In discussing this with my sister, who lives in Atlanta, there were things that I wrote about that I sent to her, and I've always had this impression that my sister was the queen of the household. But I do remember times when she and my mother got into it. But I don't remember times when she and my dad got into it. And she wrote back, reading what I had written
yeah.
about my experiences, she wrote back and said, "You're not the only one who lived this."
Mm.
And that gave me a different perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
Were we typical? Given the times, yes.
Nobody's typical. You look typical, but you're not. One of the sad things, actually really tragic, and I had no idea of this. As I said, mm-hmm. Roger's been coming on my show when I had a show. Over, you know, and coming in talking about various...
Even before I started writing the book.
Oh, yeah.
I pop in every so often.
Various moments in your life, and then in the incredibly small world of Zelig that you are, I'd have a guest on, and Roger would come in, and I go, "Roger, this is so-and-so." You go, "Oh, I know, I went to high school with her. Oh, I know."
Mm-hmm.
You had a brother who died.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? You write about it very movingly in the book. Talk about it, though.
Rick was 6 years older than I was, the eldest of the family. Linda was born 4 years later, and then I was 2 years after that. Rick had a lot of pressure on him, in my opinion, mm-hmm. from my parents. A lot was expected of him, and he was brilliant. Aced everything. For example, my grandparents on both sides, but mainly my mother's parents, who emigrated from Russia. My uncle and aunt, Goldfield, were born in Russia. And so the four of them emigrated to the United States. So Yiddish was a big
sure.
language for them. My brother took Hebrew in Sabbath school. Hebrew school.
As you would have, as your sister.
As I also did,
yes.
But trust me, he remembered 9,000% more than I ever was able to remember. And then he took German in high school.
Wow.
Because that's who Rick was.
Yeah.
And he learned Yiddish from combining the two, which is what Yiddish is.
Yes,
he
it is.
He figured
it's
everything
out. You learn on your own. It's tough
right.
that way.
He figured everything out. So
did
now,
your parents speak Yiddish at home?
They did, but not like
yeah.
full
right.
conversations.
Right. Sure.
They'd fall into Yiddish from time to time. They'd fall into phraseology from time to time because it was familiar with them. So
we got a break here yeah. before we get
I'll,
into
I'll keep on
more.
With that.
No, yeah. yeah, more about your brother. It's sad. It's sad. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are talking to Roger Badish about his really remarkable life captured in the pages of The Unplanned Life, The Journey of Roger Badish, which is a very nice cover. Eckhart's Press, which does a lot of local luminaries, literary efforts, really does a nice job of book production. You're talking about your older brother Rick, six mm-hmm. years older than you, and I'm going to say smarter than you think.
Way thought. Smarter. But the one thing that I was better than him at was swimming, believe it
okay,
or not.
Okay, I believe
we were both members of the Y. My mom and dad made sure that all three of us could swim. We took all the lessons there, went up through all the different fishes.
Sure.
I think I made it as far as minnow. but Rick never learned how to put his head in the water.
Really?
To, you know, yeah, you put yeah, it in, yeah. take a breath, put
to
your head
really
in.
Really swim.
Yeah, right. But he so I knew how to do that better than him. He was not sports
minded.
Yeah, right. He was not athletic. He was more into technology. He was more into education.
Was he the first generation? I can't remember mm-hmm. offhand. Your parents were terribly proud he was going to college, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Dad never finished college. He never went to college
right.
to start with.
Right.
Mom didn't go to college.
Right.
Rick went to IIT for a year. He went to Kendall College for a year. Then he went down to SIU. And, gosh, now I'm trying to think. If I had another. So he, 4, 5, 6. He would have been a junior at SIU. Now, his major was broadcasting.
Thereby being a certain influence on your eventual
yeah,
career.
Definitely.
No question.
No, not at all. I actually, he recorded one of his jazz shows. He loved jazz, loved it, and did a jazz show on, I think, Saturday or Sunday nights on WSIU-FM. Mm. And we actually have a reel.
Oh, how great.
Of one of the full shows, music and all,
oh,
not
oh,
edited.
Great.
Which I can hear his voice. So, unfortunately, in the Badish family, cars and our bodies don't really agree, especially when we're not in the car.
Yeah.
We took a trip as a young family to Washington, D.C. And one day, and this is in the book, one day a D.C. Capitol police officer came looking for the rest of the family. My brother and my dad had gone to get the car. We were at the Treasury building after having just toured.
Yeah, sure.
And they came up, asked we were the Badish family, and said, get in the car. I'm driving. We've got to drive you over. And there's my brother lying on the ground in an intersection, my dad holding his arm. Some driver just wasn't paying attention. Plowed into Rick, who pushed Dad down, but he was okay. Then came the situation at SIU.
Yeah.
Coming back from a radio show in the broadcasting building, communications building, and late at night. And there's two highways that cut through the middle of Carbondale.
51 and I can't remember.
And both of them, one of them is a north-south. And it comes up through a very unlit section of the south end of the school. And he had just gotten a ride by one of his friends on a motorcycle. Yep. He got off at the power plant to go across,
walk across the highway
and cut through the railroad tracks in order to get to the housing complex on the other side. And he, from what my dad told me that he was told, Rick was about two steps away from the curb. And a car came flying out of a curve going north, didn't see him, hit him.
Drunk driver, right?
Drunk driver, though he was never
charged, yeah.
They went to court and nothing happened.
Well, it's sad, and I know that you get a few pages on the book after that tragic thing, and I'm sorry for that. But you say, when you work for a radio station, you say, over the next 4 years, while I enjoyed disc jockeying for the love of music and talking, I eventually came to feel the most comfortable and qualified for the field of news reporting and anchoring. Elaborate for me, will you?
Well, I, as it says, DJing for the love of the music.
Yes.
I love music, almost all kinds. I could sit day and night listening to music.
Sure.
I was good at it. Wasn't great. I was good at management. Wasn't great. I was pretty good at producing things, pre-recorded programs. I was good at I was very good at talking with people. And felt most comfortable and most adept at following the news, getting details, writing, reporting. That's my comfort zone.
Yeah, it still is. But you had some flings here. One of the most interesting part-time jobs of anybody I've ever known. Roger went to work because your sister was working there for Playboy.
Yeah.
And I'll not read, he was a front desk guy for a while, but here's the greatest line ever. Rowan, Dan, listen, this is your Roger Badish. And the funny thing was that I became friends with some of the bunnies after work when we'd go over to the Faces Discotheque on Rush Street to unwind. Keep in mind, this was the summer of 1971. I was only 19. I was walking into a bar with Playboy Playmates when I was 19. No one ever questioned my age or asked for an ID. Then that quickly moves to you saying, Playboy Hotel, front desk, may I help you? And the guy on the other end of the phone says, yeah, this is Elton John's road manager. We'd like to book some rooms for him and his party. The next thing you know is they have given Roger tickets to the Elton John concert, which is, you had never been to a concert in Chicago by yourself.
No.
Then you go through a number of different, there's Pizza Hut jobs.
At the same time I was working at Playboy. So I'd get done at a shift at Playboy, and there was a Pizza Hut just off of Rush Street. It's
Cedar.
Pancake House
Maybe Cedar. Oh, no, no, Bellevue. Yeah. Bellevue.
Yeah.
It's that
like
same building.
There was a club on the corner, and then there was the Pizza Hut.
Yes, there was. Then he gets a job. He's selling stuff at radio. He's in radio. And he goes into this story I didn't know.
Okay.
I don't know if I want to end. Yeah. You meet a woman named Bridget.
Yeah.
Tells you what? She says, upon later reflection, because you asked her, hey, what'd you really think of me?
Yeah, I called her into the room as I was writing. I go, look, this is what I just wrote.
This is my memory of the whole thing.
I says, what's yours?
And she says, within seconds, I heard her, I wanted to see you, Bridget said in reflection. I thought something special could go on between us. The other waitress was one of my roommates, and I told her about you coming in the first time. She knew who you were. Was it actually love at first sight on her part and yours?
I think it was like at first sight. Again, I was totally oblivious to any type of male-female relation.
Except with the Playboy bunny. Yeah,
well, look, you've been that wasn't...
Around, you'd been hanging around with bunnies. So
yeah, but they were just
there.
They were just people. But
many of them were married, too.
Most of them were married, kids, and in school. Yeah.
But I must tell you this, too. 4 pages after what I just read you, actually 3 pages, Roger Badish and his bride-to-be are getting married in Las Vegas.
Well, go ahead. We got married just prior to going to Las Vegas.
Wait a minute.
We got married at my folks' house in Evanston.
Oh, yeah, you got a very small wedding. Yeah,
extremely small.
Small wedding, and then took off
shortly
for Vegas.
Thereafter.
We'll talk about the Vegas years when we take a little commercial and or news break. But we're never going to get, we're only going to get the half of it. I got 10 more minutes with Roger after the break, and it just means he'll be on again, because the book, The Unplanned Life, The Journey of Roger Badish, needs and deserves that kind of time. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are deep, not that deep, we're only 61 pages in, to Roger Badish's wonderful, wonderful memoir, The Unplanned Life, The Journey of Roger Badish. You hear his voice on the radio frequently on this station. He has been on a number of stations, but you don't know him until you read this book. You have a brush with selling life insurance, and here is how that goes. I'm reading from the book. After I completed training, I tried to get into selling to the students at ISU. I was a complete failure. I got one policy sold to Bridget. And that policy eventually lapsed. Why do you think, Roger, I'm curious about that. You're such a personable guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had some success with sales. But why?
Well, so I had a lot to live up to. My father was a life insurance, as was his father before him. Dad started, many people may not remember this, but Dad had a debit, which he walked. So this is an area where your customers are. So he would walk from building to building, many of them walk-ups, fourplexes. He would have to go in and weekly collect nickels and dimes for the weekly policy payments.
Yeah.
And he kept a debit book, which was very thick. I'm trying to make a comparison. I can't.
Yeah.
It's extremely thick, and he had 2 of them.
Wow.
Because he was very good at what he did.
Yeah.
And then spend the weekends with his old adding machine, making sure that everything balanced. So I had a lot to live up to, because Dad was also very gregarious with people.
Mm-hmm.
But he could close. I couldn't close.
Gotcha.
I could sit for hours and talk to you about your family and this,
and
get to know the
kids.
Someone would
say, nice to see you, and you go, wait, I got to sell you something.
Yeah, right. And they would say, we don't need anything.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, fine. You don't. Mm-hmm. You're right. You don't. And it just didn't work out. And of course, it didn't work out, because my dad always told me as I was growing up, don't become an insurance salesman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I actually, at one point, worked with him in his same office.
Oh, wow.
In Highland Park, Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. He was not a full-time worker at the time, but that was his home office, and he still had accounts. This is how good Dad was. You always go off commissions on life insurance sales.
Right.
A lot of sales are like that, commissions. And Dad hadn't been working for quite some time, but he still had his accounts. Every time January 1st came around, they had a big board in the office of what everyone was making and what place they were in.
Mm.
Kind of a competition.
Sure.
Every January 1st, his name was at the top of the board, just based on the commissions from selling for over 40 years.
What did he think of you going out to Vegas and getting in radio? He and your mom.
There was a lot leading up to it already. One, wanting to do the same thing my brother had done at the same school my brother was at so soon after my brother's accident. That did not sit well at all. Mary Bridget.
Did they think you should find your own path, or did they want you to get out of that shadow?
They didn't tell me no. Huh. They just let me know they were not happy, and what was I doing to them? And I, again, oblivious to real life, living my own little dream world, I'm like, I'm just doing what I want to do. I know I'm good at this. I'm not good at education. I'm not, even though I taught later.
Well, you did, yeah.
Right. But
we haven't gotten to the teaching portion, and Lord knows what he taught those Playboy bunnies.
I barely graduated grade school. I barely graduated junior high, and I barely graduated high school, and barely graduated college. I missed my graduation by, at that time, SIU was on quarters, not semesters. But because I had gotten sick while I was at school, I missed a whole quarter of grade. So I graduated in August, and even that was questionable. So I was not the student my brother was. I had no talent. I couldn't hold a note if you gave me a reinforced bag to hold in it. I cannot sing. I cannot memorize lines to be a stage actor. But my brother and my sister could do all that. I can't. I had to find something. And surprisingly, it's this.
Well, it's also this. Actually, I've been gone for 2 months from the show. Over the next 2 months, we will get to the end of Roger Badish's book. It's really remarkable, frankly. And we haven't even touched on the Vegas years or the PR years or the City Hall years. You can buy the book and read along with us. It's called The Unplanned Life, The Journey of Roger Badish. Just Google it, and it will pop up. Mm-hmm. Roger, congratulations.
Thank you.
Get ready for episode 2 of The Unplanned Life on the radio.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We'll take a little break, and then I'm having producer Rashonda Coleman in here to tell me what she's been up to, but more to the point, she's a bright young kid, and what she thinks of what's been going on in our town. Dan Long, the great engineer of this show, will be on in a week or two to catch me up on his life. So we'll be back with Rashonda in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I hope you've been entertained and or enlightened by my return to the radio. We live in very precarious times, and I must tell you that while I was sitting at home recovering from this nasty COVID, believe me, this is not a disease for sissies, I thought a lot about Dan Long, who engineers here, but especially about Ro Coleman, who's been the producer of this show for, Ro, how long, about a year?
Yeah, we're about a year in.
About a year. She is a very, very bright and personable African-American woman who was going to Chicago State for a while. I think you're still there?
Yep. So last year was my first year, and now I'm about to graduate in May, next May.
Next May?
Next May coming up, yep.
Yeah, I hope you can do graduation in person. But given what's been going on over the last, especially the last 2 weeks, how do you feel about what's going on? I know that's such a broad kind of question to ask. How old are you?
I'm 25.
So change the world is what you want to do.
Yeah.
You're seeing out there.
It's what I'm seeing, and it's what I've been actively a part of myself. I've been out on the front lines that Saturday when everything blew up and we just saw protest after protest that continued on for days. I was there downtown, front lines, you know, ready to make that change and make that walk. And I'll be honest, I don't know, these are crazy times. I've never thought in my lifetime that it would get this serious again.
Yeah.
This is nothing new, however, to our country. This is nothing new to
American
experience.
It's not. You know, one of the differences is there are now video. There are now phones.
Yeah, the internet.
Just think for one second. If someone did not tape that George Floyd murder,
yeah,
we're talking about COVID. There needed to be some kind of catalyst, not for anger, but for justice and for change. Is that the way you see it?
I agree. I think a lot, we're in this position where it's we're both traumatized by this, because now we're in a society where, with the internet and these camera phones, in a matter of seconds, a video can go viral and millions of people all over the world can see it. And so it's very traumatizing to see that. Because remember, the last time that we saw images like this before social media, before the internet, was Emmett Till.
Yeah.
But before that, outside of just lynchings that on the street, that was not a part of our history. And so it is very traumatizing. But at the same time, I think it is something that was necessary.
Sure.
Because I think, especially with modern day America, a lot of people like to pretend like we live in this post-racial world.
Nonsense.
Nonsense. And it's complete.
Well, a lot of people thought too. I mean, a lot of people, everybody thought, okay, we've elected a African-American man president. We're now in a post-racial society. And I will say nonsense to that. It never happened.
It never changed.
The dialogue, it happened in corners and here and there. And
absolutely,
I don't see any big change. What did you think? You know, I have the feeling, and I did some marching too, and just, you know, with my mask on, as so people said, what'd you say? When I'd ask him a question. But I did not sense, I sensed more hope than anger. That's a real general statement to make. But what people, I think, see as anger is actually frustration.
I think it's both. You know what? I think people are right to believe it's anger, because it is. I think people have to understand, though, that it's more than anger. I think that a lot of people are saying it one way or the other. It's like you either feel like it's anger, or you feel like people are just, you know, looking for hope. And to be honest, and this is, you know, again, I only really speak for myself and how
I'm feeling.
Of course,
But
to be honest, I think it's a mashup between pain. It's a mashup between trauma, constant trauma. And it's a mashup between, you know, anger and hopelessness. I think we feel like there is no more hope. There is no more, you know what I mean, hoping that this will get better or you will understand. Because as we've seen with the transition between, you know, Barack Obama to Donald Trump in our presidency, the racism didn't ever go away. It just was hidden. And so now we're in this position where it is literally being recorded.
Resurfaces.
Yeah, it's constantly going to resurface. And as long as Trump is in presidency, and not to say these people should go away, because I'm a big proponent of knowing who your enemy is. You cannot change something if you don't know it's there to begin with.
One of the things, and I'd love your opinion on this, Roe Coleman, one of the things that I think many people marching, there's a sense that change can be quick. You're too smart to think that, I think. But do you get a sense out there that many people will be disappointed when, you know, the Minneapolis City Council or something voted to, you know, defund police? But, like, okay, that's fine, but, like, what are you replacing them with? I mean, that's a big, bold move.
Yes.
But I am hoping, and I'm sure you are too, that there will be other big, bold moves with some kind of roadmap to how we get to this other place, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think, and I do want to say that there is a roadmap for this. So in regards to this push to defund the police, because Minnesota is not the only city, you know, they're not the only state after this. We were out even in Chicago saying that that's something that we wanted as well, to defund the police department. And I think, I know that people are hearing this and they're like, what the heck? You know what I mean? What are we going to do without the police? What are we going to do about crime? And they're afraid. But I think it's a lot. It's worth the research. I will always say that. It's always worth the research. What people have to understand.
Well, certainly worth. It's also certainly worth the conversation.
Yes, and it is. It's a bold move, but it may be one worth making, because with everything that is going on and with the plan that they have in, you know, that they're offering up for this, they're just saying first of all, let's make one thing clear. They're not saying take all the money away from the police right now.
Right.
That is not what they mean by defund the police. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is shrink some of what we're giving to the police, because in every city, the police is the highest paid department, period. And it has been shown through several different statistics that there are other departments that are more equipped to deal with some of the things that police officers have now replaced. They've become beyond becoming jury and judge, they've become healthcare professionals. They've become, you know what I mean? They've been stepping into positions that
it's a matter of rethinking the system, because the system is broken.
Absolutely.
In so many different ways. How did you react to that horrible night of looting and craziness and arson? And where were you? Were you at home? Were you watching?
I was at home. I had just gotten home, though.
Yeah.
And there are pictures still resurfacing of me and my boyfriend down there going nuts. And what I mean by going nuts is just protesting. We didn't participate in any of the looting. And we had honestly gotten home. I think it started about 30 minutes after we got home.
Where do you live? What neighborhood?
So we're back in the suburbs. So I'm in Olympia Fields now.
Okay.
But we just moved from 95th. So we were right here over in the Roseland area. And I don't, you know what? I know a lot of people are not going to agree with me on this.
It's okay.
But to be honest, I don't know that I have a problem with it. I think the only thing that I have a problem with in regards to the looting is the stealing. But I think at this point, you know, you have a group of people who are not only terrified, like I personally have constant conversations with my boyfriend because we have a future we want to build together.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have children in this world. I don't want, as a black woman, to be afraid that if my son steps out of his door without realizing his position, quote unquote, in this world, that the wrong cop will come and I'll never see my son again. That's a very scary reality.
Have I met your boyfriend?
You have met my boyfriend.
He's that kind of handsome man who sits in that on that couch
that
sometimes when I see him.
Yes, very much so.
What are the two of you, if you're talking about, and obviously if you're thinking about marriage and children, you're thinking about a future together. Do you want to make that future here? Do you see, or are you, you must be, Ro Coleman, hopeful that this firecracker that we've just lived through, this tragedy that we have lived through, will lead to a better world? I mean, you've got to have that hope.
I'm hoping that people are starting to see the pain and the anger and the traumatization through actions. I think that a lot of this would not have happened if we felt like there was some justice. And we're not alone in this. I think that it's also like we can't forget our allies. There are people all over the world who are dealing with these same issues and the lootings and things. So,
but there have also been, one of the things that's really intrigued me about this are the number of people who are marching in other cities, in other countries around this world.
It's amazing.
And it, you know, I will make a leap. I will say, well, okay, maybe some of them are like, have been cooped up too long with COVID and the COVID crisis and just want to get out and do something. But the numbers have been astonishing. This is now a kind of worldwide wave. You're not thinking of staying in this idiotic radio business in the future, are you?
I don't know, man. I don't know. Radio and TV are the core of my career and my life. And I don't know if I'll be in radio forever, but I do want to be in media. I loved being out there. I love the journalistic side. I love taking pictures. I love just being a part of all of it.
Yeah, you've worked for a little bit for the Sun-Times. You worked a little bit for Channel 7. I mean, that is, the medium is the message, man, and that is one place.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, I think, frankly, local TV news could use. Well, there's no question that every news organization in this city needs more people of color because it is not reflected in the reporting.
And
you have to have people who know these neighborhoods and have been in these neighborhoods and know what they're talking about and know who to talk to in those neighborhoods too.
Absolutely. But I do also think that it's a level of education that we have to have that starts young.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a lot of what we're dealing with is just ignorance and lack of education.
Yeah. Knowing other people. We've got to have this dialogue.
Yeah. Not being able to see somebody else's side, you know?
Yeah. Ro, I am glad to be back. I am glad to know you. Dan Long, I'm glad to know you too. I want to end this return to radio life with a song by Oscar Brown Jr., a song that haunts me and has haunted me for many, many years, and I think it's appropriate to play tonight. I haven't said this in a long time. See you next Sunday.
It seems